Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us tonight for our live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Jessica from Greenlight, and we are excited to host tonight's event with Michael Ian Black presenting his new book, A Better Man. He's going to be talking with Liz Plank, so you are in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Michael, Liz, and the team at Algonquin Books for making this happen, and to all of you for buying a ticket and showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces right now, our community of authors and readers is still here, and we're grateful for your support and for the chance to make spaces for conversation and connection. We are recording tonight's event, so look for audio or video versions on Greenlight Bookstore's social media channels later on. You can order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. I'll paste the buy link in the chat. Or you can even stop in and shop at one of our stores 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. Tuesday to Saturday. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying a book is a great way to show your support. Our interviewer for this evening is Liz Plank. She's an award-winning journalist, author, and the creator and host of Heart Homework, a podcast that offers emotional support for an increasingly chaotic news cycle. Prior to launching her own production company, she was the executive producer of several critically acclaimed series at Vox Media. She is the author of the book For the Love of Men, A New Vision for Mindful Masculinity, which was published by St. Martin's Press in September 2019. Liz is ranked as one of the 50 most influential women by Marie Claire and was named one of Forbes' 30 Under 30 in media, and she regularly appears on national and international television programs to provide a perspective on politics, gender issues, and reproductive rights. She'll be talking tonight with our featured author, Michael Ian Black. He's an actor, comedian, and writer who started his career with a sketch comedy show, The State, on MTV, and has created and starred in many other television shows. His movie appearances include Wet Hot American Summer, The Baxter, and Sextuplets. He's also the author of several books for children, including the award-winning I'm Bored, I'm Sad, and I'm Worried, and the parody A Child's First Book of Trump. His books for adults include the memoir You're Not Doing It Right and the essay collection My Custom Van. He appears on several popular podcasts and regularly tours the country as a stand-up comedian. In his new book, A Better Man, A Mostly Serious Letter to My Son, Black offers a way forward for boys, men, and anyone who loves them in a world in which the word masculinity now often goes hand in hand with the word toxic. Written as a heartfelt letter to his college-bound son, it's part memoir, part advice book, and it's been praised by fellow authors and entertainers, including Samantha Bee, Peggy Orenstein, Alyssa Milano, and Liz Plank herself, who writes, "Michael's voice is necessary now more than ever to offer men a different path where they can be curious about their own gender and mount their own revolution for better definition of masculinity." And she adds, "I'm so glad that this book exists." So you're in for some good stuff tonight. Michael's going to start us off with a reading from the book, and then he'll be talking with Liz and then taking your questions at the end. Michael, please take it away.
Well, thank you, Jessica. Thank you, Greenlight. And thank you, Liz, for hosting me on this, my first stop on my virtual book tour. There's some pros and cons of being the first. The con is I don't really know what I'm doing or feel comfortable with what I'm doing. But that's also the pro because and it feels like anything can happen. First, I guess before I start reading, Liz, you're under 30?
No, I was at one point. And I'm now 30. I think I'm 33, but this year doesn't count, right?
No,
I had a birthday this year, but I don't think we're counting this year. So I'm still 32.
That makes sense to me. That makes me feel better because you're very accomplished and I'd like you to be a little bit older.
Yeah, a little bit.
just so I don't feel bad about myself. All right, I'll read a little bit. Again, like this is the first time, so I don't even know what to read. So I'm picking more or less at random.
Ooh.
This is chapter 2. Rosary, it's entitled, and then there's a kind of subtitle to every chapter. This is called Tell Your Kids You Love Them. Now, I feel like I have to preface everything by saying, like, I know I'm a comedian, like, I know that's my job, but it feels like less and less of who I am and what I do. And this book is deliberately entitled Mostly Serious. So I'm worried that people are going to be disappointed if I'm not like very funny. But then again, I have a long history of disappointing people. So I feel like that will be on brand for me. Rosary, tell your kids you love them. And this is a letter to my son, this book. So chapter two, one of my favorite photos of my dad, your grandpa, is also one of the last he ever took. He's 39. In the photo, Dad wears a slight embarrassed smile below the goofy teddy bear baseball cap his wife, Beth, had given him to cover the new scar that stretches across his skull. He'd undergone emergency brain surgery a couple months before, after the police found him unconscious. An assault, they thought. Maybe a mugging gone bad, they didn't know. My mom told us about it the following morning. He was going to be okay, she said. And I remember thinking something like, of course he's going to be okay. I'd never considered that my father could be hurt, let alone die. A few days later, your Uncle Eric and I went to see him at the hospital. I remember him in bed, head shaved and bandaged, sleepy and frail, his body covered in a loose gown. I felt awkward and unsure and scared. His fragility frightened me more than anything else. He'd never been a big guy, but every father is a giant to his son, although less so when his son overtakes him in height, as you, annoyingly, have done to me. We stayed with him for an hour or so that day, but he didn't talk much, and when we left him, I felt relieved. When Dad came home, he was weak and unsure on his feet. That Christmas, Beth gave him teddy bears, lots of teddy bears, big and small. One of the bears was sewn to the brim of a baseball cap, the dumb hat in the photo. A few months later, he would be back in the hospital where he died from a blood clot. I remember that tight smile of his. It was his all-purpose smile. It could mean joy, sorrow, frustration, bafflement, or some combination of those. It's a smile unwilling to commit to emotion. Every now and again, I catch myself making that same smile, and I get a tingle of deja vu. It's funny, I look more like my mom. I have her coloring and some of her facial features, but I have never felt possessed by her in the same way I do when I discover my dead father's expression on my face. One of the things that haunts me still is the ambivalence I felt about him when he was alive. My parents' divorce had been bitter, interminable. My mother's grievances with my father spilled into our daily conversations at home and over the years toward him. Was he really, as she maintained, a sexist? Was he really not upholding his obligations to her and to us? Did he really not love our younger sister, Susan, who has Down syndrome? I looked for proof of his failings and found it. Once he bought me a baseball mitt for my birthday, a good gift, until I realized he bought a right-handed glove. Didn't he know I am left-handed? Didn't he care? A simple mistake, but I filed it away as evidence against him. I ignored the evidence in his favor, the trip to Indian Guides camp, the visits to the boardwalk on the Jersey Shore to play skee ball, the time he helped us carve our names out of wood blocks, the weekends we spent with his sister and her girls. I have another photo of him. It might be the only one with the two of us together. I'm young, maybe 5 or 6, which means he would have been in his early 30s. We're at the Guinness World Records Museum in New York City, posing in front of a giant, perhaps world record holding, house of cards. I've got my hands shoved into the pockets of my puffy winter coat. My dad towers over me, his hand resting on my shoulder, that same smile on his face. I don't remember that trip, but I feel as though I remember the weight of his hand, the protection and love it held. It's a good start. Now, I'm feeling emotional reading it, and I did not want to feel emotional because as I'm a guy, I don't want to feel things at all.
That was beautiful. That line, even I remember reading it and stopping on that line myself and being emotional. So I can't imagine what it's like for you to read it, and to all of us. So thank you for that beautiful reading. Thank you to everyone who is with us today. I personally think that this is cool. I think it's cool that we have like a chat. Like, it's just not normally at an event, it's, you know, we're talking and then you guys get a turn, and this, we all get to sort of do this in a cool kind of funky kind of way. So I love that you were already in there making jokes about, like, so you have poison ivy? What's going on?
Oh, I have poison ivy. Yeah. Yeah.
What, you from where? What, you're leaving your house? Where? Oh, wow. All up in your
arm. This isn't the worst of it.
Did you fall? Why is it on your, were you grazing the grass as you were going on a hike?
One of the things that has transpired over the last several weeks, Liz, is I have become an outdoorsman.
My gosh.
Yeah, it's a new phase in my life. I think it may be some sort of midlife crisis, but it started because my friend Matthew said to me, have you seen this show called Alone? And I said, no. And I said, don't tell me anything about it. I want to watch. Yeah. You recommended it? Fine, I'm going to watch. So it's a reality show. I don't watch reality shows. And had I known it was a reality show, I probably wouldn't have watched it. But apparently in the seventh season, I turned it on and I got hooked. It's about these people, 10 contestants I get, who get dropped off individually in the Arctic and have to survive essentially by themselves. They're survivalists. That's what they do. They're hunters, trappers, crazy mountain people. And so they build shelters and they hunt and they trap. And I'm watching this before. I'm like, I kind of want to do that. So I have no outdoor skills. I mean, you can tell I'm wearing a cardigan. That tells you everything you need to know about my outdoorsmanship. But the other week, my wife, Martha, was like, we had a hurricane come through here and a tree fell on our property and was kind of obscuring our view to the road from our driveway. And she's like, you need to clear the tree. I'm like, sure, absolutely. I'll clear the tree. Mm-hmm. Clearing the tree. I just figured at some point the tree will disappear on its own.
Right.
And a week goes by and she's like, I thought you said you were going to clear the tree. I'm like, I will. Finally, one morning I wake up and I'm like, I'm going to clear that tree because I'd been watching Alone. I'm like, I'm going to do some outdoorsy shit. But I don't know how to clear a tree. I have a chainsaw that you I don't know how to operate it. I bought it. I tried to do the thing with all my strength. I could not get it to start. The chainsaw has sat in our garage for 5 years, unused, never been used. And I'm like, I'm not fucking with the chainsaw. So I got a little saw that she has for like gardening. And I just started hacking away at the tree piece by piece. And I got really into it. And I was clearing all the brush on the hillside. And somewhere along the way, I contracted contact dermatitis. I don't know that it's specifically poison ivy, but it's poison ivy-esque.
It's so funny because I remember a part of the book where you talk about the fact that being a man means that your wife wakes up in the middle of the night and is like, if she hears a noise, you have to die first. That's your job. You go down so that you just encounter the murderer first. And then
obviously the first one murdered in the house.
Yeah, the first one murdered. and in this case, the first one to get poison ivy. So you protected your wife. You did your manly duty.
Well, but the thing is, she is not, she's one of these rare people who is invulnerable to poison ivy.
What? Exists? Some people don't feel
it? Some people don't have an allergic reaction to it. So she... And she'll like flaunt it. She'll be like, oh, look, here's some poison ivy. I don't even get it.
That's a little rude. That's a little rude. Well, look, I'm so happy and honored really to be with you today to talk about this gorgeous book. You also, I've already been asked by my boyfriend, where does he get this hat? Because it's genius. And I know that a lot of people are going to want the book and also want to flaunt the hat to... show how much they love the book. I have so many thoughts about it, and I really enjoyed reading it. I think one of the most powerful things about it is its format, right? And like the medium is the message. Like this is a compassionate, empathetic, loving letter or letters to your son when I think many of us don't, you know, have complicated relationships with our fathers. You had a complicated relationship with yours. And so I love that you've, through this, become sort of the surrogate dad for a lot of people who may not have received an I love you or a letter or any kind of guidance from their fathers. So I wanted to start off just by asking, you know, you talk about your father in the book a lot. We obviously learn a lot about you, and you talk a little bit about your son, but what is, did you see sort of generational differences, or what to you is the most glaring difference between the masculinity and the manhood ideals of your father, yours, and then your son?
As I was writing the book, one of the things that really started to sink in with me is not only the differences between my dad, me, and my son, but I can kind of reach back to his dad also, who I really didn't know, but I feel like I do. I feel like I feel like I can kind of intuit him. I remember him and kind of knew him enough to understand that my father's father had been a cop, a New York City cop, at a time, and I'm sure this is still true, when there weren't a lot of Jewish New York City cops. But he was a first generation, maybe second generation kid, and I think it was a good kind of civil servant job. I don't think he had any passion for police work or anything. But he was, you know, a product of this silent generation, or maybe what the generation that comes right before that. You know, he was a very buttoned up, kind of a tough guy. And my dad really wasn't that. My dad, I think, was much gentler by nature, and but retained, I think, a lot of that really buttoned up stoicism. He didn't know how else to be. Mm. And then when I came along, just on a personality basis, like we're just different. And I grew up in a lesbian household. When my parents divorced, it's because my mom became involved with another woman. And, you know, I was always artsy, which is the worst. And I was always like emotive, which is the worst, you know. My mom called me her sensitive child, which I think she sort of meant as a compliment, but never felt to me like one. And generationally, like, you know, I grew up sort of post 60s and living in a time of in a household, a very kind of ardent, almost strident feminism. And I was sort of conditioned to be a little more open and liberal with my feelings. But all of that being said, I still feel that same reluctance, that same cultural stoicism, that same hardening emotionally. And I see it in my son. He is, I think, a pretty sensitive kid, but he's 19 now, but is very kind of ironic in the way he looks at the world, the way I think a lot of his generation looks at the world, the way I sort of built an entire career out of being. And sometimes it's hard to break through, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't want to particularly open up. He'll talk to me, and he's actually a good conversationalist, but it's a struggle sometimes to pierce that shell.
Mm. Yeah. And I, one of the best lines of the book, where you sort of talk about masculinity as a performance, which is sort of the point your dad, your dad's dad, and your son, you're all different people, but you're all sort of being boxed into the same kind of box, and these ideals and these pressures of masculinity, which you delve into in the book, whether it's, you know, always showing that you're strong, that you're invulnerable, but also mixing up strength, with you know, courage, and you talk about dignity and how those things are very different, and we have a totally misunderstanding when it comes to what it does look like to be strong. One of the best parts is when you talk about being, I think 7 or 8 years old, and you go to a one of your parents' friend's house, and there's a dog. You get attacked by a golden retriever who wants to lick you to the bone, and you started to cry, and some adult in the room, a male adult in the room, said, "Be a man." And you make this amazing point of, you know, no one tells girls be a woman, right? But in sort of being uncomfortable or being so afraid that boys won't become men, do we in a way kind of perpetually keep them as boys, right? That we don't teach them how to deal with difficult emotions, how to deal with discomfort, the sort of emotional training that I think is more natural for girls because we don't feel as afraid of their emotions. Do you think that there's a sort of irony there?
So weird what you just brought up to me, that manhood is always conditional in a way that womanhood is not.
Yeah.
Manhood is always being judged. Is that the manly thing to do or the most manly thing to do? I repeatedly refer to this SNL sketch from 1979 in the book called Quien es Más Macho, which is an absurd sketch where Bill Murray is hosting this fake Venezuelan game show where the contestants have to identify which of two random male celebrities is more macho based on nothing. And what's crazy is what makes the sketch work is you can do it because manhood is conditional, because you can rate every single thing about a guy and put him along an axis of masculinity. And women, I don't feel like have that in the same way. Women obviously have tremendous other pressures, but people don't question womanhood in the same way that they question manhood, because it's biological, because we just assume once a woman reaches kind of reproductive age, well, she's a woman now. Mm-hmm. And you say, like, when a girl gets her period, like, well, you're a woman now. There's point where a boy is like, oh, you're a man now. And the closest we have is like a bar mitzvah, and nobody mistakes those 13-year-olds coming out of the
men. Do you think that that's why it constantly needs to be proven? Because you never are a man.
There's no,
you're never right. Man enough.
Yeah. Because the way that like manhood is sort of formatted in the culture, it's almost formatted as a competition where, at base, at the very bottom of it, I think, is that fundamental thing of two dudes looking at each other and going, can I take him? Yeah. Like, I really think that's at the base of it. It's so anachronistic at this point, but it's so deeply embedded in our DNA. It's almost cellular, but it's useless. It's junk DNA at this point. It doesn't serve us at all.
Right. And I think that's one of the most important points you make in the book, which is that, we talk a lot about how women are afraid of men, but that men are afraid of men too. And I was, I'm wondering if you can sort of expand on that. Because I've, often repeated the saying of like patriarchy is a pyramid scheme, that this conversation is so important for women, right? If we rethink and we remodel masculinity, it by definition enhances the lives of women, but it also enhances the lives of men. And I kind of wonder, why don't men talk more about this? If it is something that they're dealing with, a fear that they're dealing with and that they've always dealt with, why is it like Fight Club? Like that you can't talk about it?
The answer is in the question.
Yeah.
If we agree, and I have to agree because it's kind of my premise, that manhood is based on this idea of ultimately like, can I take this guy? It requires a level of invulnerability. You have to create armor around yourself at all times, and that armor definitionally does not allow you to go, hey, wait, I'm scared.
And why then aren't men excited when we bring up masculinity? Why are the people often who are the most upset about these conversations, as you talk about in the book, the trolls that you get online, why does it come so much from men then?
I sense it's because they feel like they have the most to lose. Because I think my sense is, and I can't speak for everybody, I can only speak for myself, but my sense is there's a kind of precariousness about people's own ideas of themselves, their own masculinity. They feel unsure in it for these reasons. Like, you know, you work so hard sort of mentally to puff yourself up into a guy, to a man, to be able to move into the world with what passes as confidence. And when somebody then starts questioning the underpinning of that, that's pretty threatening. And you, I think you have to have some grounded sense of who you are in order to be able to move through that discomfort and feel like you're not being threatened by those conversations. It's the one, it's a huge advantage that women have, they've created in the modern feminist movement, is they've created this tremendous space to talk about femininity, what it means, what is it, what are the different facets of it. And because women are conditioned to do this emotional work from birth, they have the space to handle those conversations. Men don't have that. Ironically, it's why I suspected and still suspect that this book isn't going to sell very well. You know what I mean? It's like men don't want to have this conversation. Or at least the men who really should have this conversation are the ones who would benefit the most from it are the least willing to have it. Women are much more receptive to this conversation, both because they feel intimidated and threatened by the patriarchy, by men, and also because they want so much for the men in their lives to do the same work that they as women have done, because they see how it benefits them. It's a pragmatic, you know, I look at this as a pragmatic book above everything else. Move forward. We just have to, because it's killing us when we don't.
Yeah, and I'm sure, as we all did, we had a lot of hope for 2020, a lot of different ideas about how this year would unfold. And I'm sure, I want to let you sort of talk about what it's been like to have a book about masculinity kind of come out in 2020, in a year where we've had this global pandemic, which, by the way, desperately affects men. Men are more likely to die from the coronavirus. Men of color are 3 times more likely, and they're particularly vulnerable. And we're seeing future members of Congress, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, talk about how children should not be wearing masks, and especially not boys, because...
What did she say that? Especially not boys?
Yeah, so she said, forcing boys to wear masks is emasculating. So, that's just the tip of the iceberg. We also have seen that leaders who engage in more posturing, right, who are more quote-unquote macho, like Bolsonaro, like Trump, have handled the crisis so much less effectively than other male leaders or even female leaders. So I'm very curious what you make of this year and the way that masculinity killing us, and particularly hurting men and the people that they love. I'm curious what it's been like for you to witness all of that and what you make of it.
It's been, just from the pandemic point of view, it's been bizarre but unsurprising. Bizarre just because it is, just because I never, you know, I read a lot of scare articles and have in the past about, you know, where they'll ask various administration officials from past administrations, what keeps you up at night? And inevitably somebody goes, a plague. And I'm always like, yeah, a plague. and then to see it unfold, like, that's like, I'm dumb about a lot of things. This was one of those things that I was dumb about. So that, just putting that in that bizarre box.
Yeah.
And seeing how our leadership, our current leadership has responded, has... with a little bit of hindsight, this kind of hindsight that we're constantly experiencing from 3 weeks ago, a month ago, 6 months ago, it's unsurprising, because so much of Trumpism all of Trumpism is about fear. And it's the same fear that is embodied in what people call toxic masculinity. this idea of invulnerability, that if you show any chinks in the armor, you are less than a man. So of course Trump isn't wearing a mask. Of course his followers aren't wearing masks. Of course they deny the science. Of course, to pretend to, or to say that you care about your own health is less masculine than saying, I don't give a shit. Mm. You know, to say that you value less masculine than saying, yeah, I don't want to die. Like, it's crazy, but true. And when I say things like that, it's like, and if you disagree, please tell me, but I feel like we all speak the language of masculinity enough to know that those are true statements. Like, we're all fluent in the language of masculinity enough to know that a guy going, I don't give a shit, is considered more masculine than a guy going, no, I kind of want to protect my life because I value it.
Mm. Totally. And do you think that, because you make so many brilliant points in the book about the links with the military and masculinity, right? That we sort of create manhood and masculinity tropes so that boys can become men and go to wars, and then to justify the wars in the first place. Do you think that if we called the coronavirus a war, that everyone would wear a mask, right? If like Trump supporters were told like masks protect you from terrorists, do you think that suddenly masks would be manly and we would have a sort of a totally different perspective on it?
I think we could have. I think if he had been a leader, and if he had understood his own power as a leader or as a cult leader, he could have done a lot of good by presenting masks as patriotic, by saying, hey, look at me, I'm wearing it. He could have done a lot of good, but it cuts so against the grain of who he is. Yeah. And I wonder if maybe it was impossible. Mm-hmm. You know, he did say things like, we're fighting an invisible enemy, like that kind of thing. But it doesn't quite resonate. I don't know why. Maybe because he didn't believe it. Maybe because he had a hard time selling it, because it's antithetical to who he is.
Right. It's interesting because I'm from Quebec, and in Quebec they had a lot of problems in old folks' homes, obviously, in these very bad outbreaks, and so they sent the military to oversee and like take care of the elderly in old folks' homes. So they, right, were like, well, we have this, you know, all of these, you know, soldiers basically who are ready to go to war, and we are at war. And so they moved in the soldiers to basically work at and like clerk and just be at the front desk and like take care of the elderly. And I just thought, yeah, that is service, right? Right now that is, and always is. But to your point, and you give so many examples in the book, I know everyone who's read it will agree, but you know, really compare the way that we comprehend the military as completely in this false view of what masculinity is. So that wouldn't even be possible in America.
That's what I was going to ask you. Like, what is the Canadian kind of military ethos? Is it the same as America's? I mean, America's really is predicated on go invade a plan. I don't know that the Canadian military is like that.
Yeah, we're not nearly, I mean, our military is smaller. Our identity as a country is not wrapped into our military, because we've, you know, only pretty much been, I mean, not to say we don't do anything bad, but usually when our military goes in, it's like as allies, it's not really to invade or to like, we don't have these huge, it's not like, you know, Justin Trudeau is not comparing the size of his missiles with anyone else. And Justin Trudeau wore a mask very early on. I think there's a real difference, right? And I want to talk about 2022 and just the election coming up and getting your thoughts, because I think we do have a choice for two very different masculinities in Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Like, do you think that Joe Biden is a soy boy? Do you think that we're just doomed and that he's too sensey to be president?
Too sensey. I think he's done a really good job. Mm. I mean, Biden was by no means my candidate. I was kind of all in for Elizabeth Warren. In some ways, I'm relieved Biden's the candidate, for all the reasons that Democrats are relieved that Biden's the candidate, because it erases the problem of having a woman running, which is clearly has been a problem. And, you know, might shave 2-3 percentage points off, you know. I was all in for Warren, and Biden was, you know, near the bottom of my list. That being said, I think he's done a really good job of presenting, for, and purely in these terms, a vision of masculinity that is strong in the sense of being committed to ideals, unwavering in his sense of self and what is right and what is wrong. That's, I think, a real strength. And strong when he shows strong in his compassion. Mm. A lot of times, I think we think about compassion as being antithetical, or empathy as being antithetical to strength. But they're, to me, they're paired. They're the same thing, because you have to have a lot of strength as a guy, especially, to overcome so much of what we've been coded to be, which is invulnerable. You have to be strong enough to step outside of that and to hear somebody else and to connect with them. That requires strength. And I've been impressed with just who he is as a man, as an empathetic guy. I know he gets sort of slagged on for being overly empathetic at times. But it's funny, it doesn't feel phony in the way that like Clinton often felt phony and performative. Maybe I'm just not as familiar with Biden yet, and maybe I'll sort of see through it at some point. But right now, like, I've been really impressed with him, and like, I, you know, he has taken on that mantle of Uncle Joe that I feel like was sort of a joke in the what was his name? Obama administration. You know, crazy Uncle Joe. But, you know, he feels pretty comforting now in a really good way. I mean, he feels like this cardigan sweater, and I'm totally comfortable voting for this cardigan sweater for president.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I would love a cardigan sweater or like 20 to hide under right now.
And finally, I think Kamala Harris was such a good choice, yeah. And the perfect choice.
Yeah. I love that your book actually reminded me of President Obama being called weak because he put Dijon mustard on his hamburger that one time. Yep. When he was out with Joe Biden. And yeah, we could sort of talk all day about the ways that, I mean, every election, I think, is about masculinity, right? Like, we often, even if we think about 2016, there's a lot of emphasis on the ways that Trump was demeaning to the women running and the woman running, against him. You could also point to so many different examples of the way that he used gendered and you know, sort of sexism against men, in his insults about, you know, Marco Rubio being tiny and Ted Cruz being a pussy, like he actually said the word pussy, right? And he has laughed at Chuck Schumer for crying when the Muslim ban came out, and Chuck Schumer was very emotional about families being ripped apart from each other. And so, you know, in Donald Trump, I think we've not only seen the ways that these ideals of masculinity can hurt women, but also how they hurt other men too, and sort of force them into roles that don't really make sense.
And what's so obvious, I think, and transparent to everybody, is how brittle and frail Donald Trump is emotionally. How his own caricature of masculinity reveals such a profound brittleness, and how he has to lash out because it's so like scared. A wrong nerve. He's so scared.
Yeah.
It's really amazing to see. And then you see, and you contrast that with somebody like Biden, who feels so secure in himself. Mm. And the kind of slings and arrows seem like they bounce off in a way that they just can't. Every arrow lands with Trump. Every arrow causes blood loss with Trump.
Yeah. And I think it reminds me of my best line in the book, your best line in the book, where you talk about masculinity as performance. I think what you're speaking to is that Biden doesn't perform masculinity, but Trump does. It's a show. Yeah. And you say that traditional masculinity is an elaborate system of ritualized posturing, a kind of drag show. It's men in carefully assembled attire lip syncing the song of their fathers and grandfathers. Sometimes I think the only thing separating RuPaul and Chuck Norris is glitter. Is the only thing separating RuPaul and Donald Trump glitter?
Well, I mean, it's pancake makeup.
You're right. The only difference is that RuPaul has less foundation.
But it's true. Like when you think about the makeup, I mean, I'm just thinking about this now. Like he is a clown putting on clown's makeup. He is creating this character of a man. Mm. And we all know his history enough to know at root how tragic it is. You know, if he wasn't such a malevolent fuck and he didn't have any power, you'd go, this is the most tragic dude. It's so sad. Yeah. Like the way clearly he was raised and shaped and whatever inherent sociopathy he inherited from his dad was given full force. And it's a guy who has clearly never felt comfortable in his own skin. And so has to surround himself with trophies, achievement awards. Mm. It just breaks my heart in a way. Yeah. From a human point of view, I am nothing but evil and ill, but just as a person, it breaks your heart.
Yeah. And you can see it. And we're going to take questions next.
But his youngest kid right now.
Yeah. I'm thinking I was just going to say.
I'm like, God, this poor kid, like the other ones are already ruined.
Yeah.
But you've got this poor gawky teenage son living somewhere in the Washington DC area. Mm. And just wondering like, what's going to become of that kid? And just feeling so kind of sad.
Yeah. Yeah. If only Donald Trump wrote a letter to his son. I would not want to read it. Probably be pretty scary if we saw what Donald Trump, but I mean, we know with Don Jr., the kind of undermining, right? That like Michael Cohen has shared this, but we already knew the way that Donald Trump just thinks so much lesser of Donald Trump Jr. and how, you know, Donald Trump Jr. just trying to compensate constantly for, you know, never feeling loved or hugged by his father is also becoming a psychopath with way too much power and just wielding it to make the world very scary.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm undecided who I'm going to vote for.
Yeah, right. Right. Well, let's see. What people in the Q&A. I've been trying to read through these amazing questions. We have a lot. So let's start with. Mark is asking that the book is a letter to your son, but how did he feel that something that is so ostensibly personal is being published? Yeah, like an 18-year-old boy being like, what the fuck, Dad? Is he cool with all of it?
Yeah, I think he's fine with it. I don't think I'm revealing too much about him. You know, it's mostly revelatory about me and my story, my own failings and shortcomings. I'm not taking him to task for anything.
Right.
He's a really good kid and I'm really grateful for him. And I'm grateful that he's grown up to be a really good young man and I'm proud of him and I hope this book is helpful for him in some way, particularly as he navigates out of the house. I mean, he's home now because college, he goes to school in Georgia and, you know, it's just kind of shut down. So he's here for the next however many months and has been home since March. But I, as I think about him going back out and being on his own, I hope he at least dips into this book now and again, if it can be of some use to him.
Yeah, I would think it's something, yeah, he'll be really happy to have for the rest of his life. What? No, no. Yeah. No. I mean, when you're alive and dead, we're all going to die. It's very clear from this year that it is all imminent. So we have a really beautiful question from Ben. Hi, Michael. I consider you an icon of a kinder, more humane new masculinity. So Ben is asking, how did you begin to unwind, to unlearn all of these performative rituals and sort of cultural expectations of manhood? Did having children was that a big part of it? And he says, thanks, stay sensitive.
I talk in this book about how I had built a comedic persona around invulnerability and insensitivity and withdrawal. And that came really easily to me. It was never who I was. I mean, I don't think anybody who knew me thought that's who I was, but I could dip into it really easily. I could become that really easily. And it gradually started to feel like a prison because I was feeling a real disconnect between who I knew myself to be and who I was presenting myself to be in public. Mm. And I made a conscious decision. It was probably around the time my son was born. And I'm sure it had a lot to do with him being born, that I didn't feel honest anymore and I couldn't do that anymore. And I wrote my first memoir about in that time, specifically for that reason, as a way to unshackle myself. And it's been a process ever since. I mean, I started this talk tonight by saying, I hope you're not upset at me if I'm not funny. It's a hard thing to unlearn. And, being funny for me is somebody else's being strong or somebody else's being macho, whatever it is. It's hard to let that go. And incidentally, I don't feel like people or men need to walk around like open wounds all the time going, look at my sensitivity, look at my feelings. I'm not advocating that. I think a lot of what masculinity is traditionally is great. I think strength is great. The way the traditional way we think about strength, fantastic. Independence, great. Endurance, fantastic. All of that is great. We need that stuff for men and for women. But we also need to expand our ideas of strength and independence and endurance. And we do need to open ourselves up a little bit more because it's just good for us. And it feels good too. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, it feels better to be that way. Like, again, like, to me, this is all pragmatic shit. Like, I'm not out there, I'm not trying to be a poet about this. Like, this is just like man work that is good for us to do. It's, it's work that will cause you to break a sweat in a good way. And that's why I want people to do it, because it's good for them and it feels good to do.
Yeah. And then we have a good question from Miranda, who is asking about how do parents teach young men about sex with this perspective in mind, and sort of deconstructing these ideals of manhood. I'm very curious what you think.
I talk a little bit in the book about, I mean, a lot, a fair amount in the book about some of my sexual history, times where I feel like I was, where I was uncomfortable in terms of my own actions, where I worried that I made other people uncomfortable, and times where other people, and where people made me uncomfortable. I know that there is not a one size fits all for sexuality. people express their sexuality in a myriad of ways? Or can you say myriad ways?
I think you can say both.
Okay, I'm going to say myriad ways. And I get most of what I say to my son in this book is confined to kind of like early sexuality. I mean, in terms of like, you know, your early experiences, because he's a young man and, you know, he's still early in that part of his life. And what I say specifically about sex is I talk a lot about consent and affirmative consent and making sure that not only he's straight, not only that she is okay with what's going on, but that he's okay with what's going on. Yeah. That it's okay for him to feel like I'm not ready and I'm not comfortable in any given situation. We often don't think about men's reluctance for sex because we just assume men always want sex. And a lot of times we do. But some of that is cultural. Yeah. Some of that is we feel like to be men, we need to constantly be pursuing sex when really what we're pursuing, at least in my case, was intimacy and not knowing the difference between the two. It's, you know, I want him to be emotionally connected and involved with his sexuality and with his sexual partners. And I don't have any problem with one night stands or, you know, I say something in the book. It's like, if you and another person want to just like go to town, do it, but just be honest with each other about what's happening. Just communicate. That's it. Just say like, I'm totally having a great time making out with you and fucking you and whatever, but that's what this is for me. Is that what this is for you?
Right.
Let's make sure that we're communicating. And if it is for both of you, great. Like, go to town, have a party. I love it.
Yeah. Love that. There's so many good questions. So I'm trying to like sift through them without leaving anyone out, but there's a lot of different, beautiful questions about parenting. And I know we just talked about sex and parenting, but you know, people asking like, what's your best advice for a young boy growing up right now? Or for the parents in the room and who are raising boys? What's your general approach and what do you think we should be doing better to take care of boys?
I want to be clear, like I'm not an expert on parenting. I'm not a perfect parent. I fuck up all the time. I say the wrong thing. I do the wrong thing. I annoy my kids. Like I'm just a dude. But I feel like for myself, you hear those dogs?
Yeah.
One of my kids.
I have something to say.
I think it's my daughter just going home from field hockey practice. But the thing that I feel like I've distilled about parenting is fairly simple, which is this. Like to me, parenting comes down to two jobs, arguably one job. The two jobs are make your kids know that they're safe and help your kids know that they're loved. Anything beyond that is kind of icing on the cake.
Yeah.
And like, if you can accomplish those two things on a daily basis, let them know they're safe, let them know they're loved. The rest, I feel like, will take care of itself because you can't control their personalities. You can't control what they do, ultimately, and you shouldn't try. Yes. You can't steer them really. It's hopeless. I tried, believe me. Like, all you can do is support them. And let them know that if they fall, you're there. You'll catch them. You'll be there unreservedly.
Yeah.
And that's enough. And that's a lot, by the way, but that's enough.
In your book, you write that the three words that are the hardest for a man to say are not, I love you, but I need help. So, you know, in addition to you're safe and you're loved, you know, it's also, and if you need help, you can ask, right? That sort of encouraging boys to not know and to ask questions, which I think, again, for girls, I mean, there's a lot of girls, I can't ask for help. This is literally like, I've spent so much money in therapy. It's embarrassing on just that. But I think there's not an entire cultural, mission to teach me that I'm never supposed to ask for directions and that I'm supposed to know everything, right? So Isn't that also part of it?
I mean, to me, that falls in the category of safe and loved. It's like, if you need help, please, I'm here. I'm always here for you. So much falls into that category for me. So maybe it's overly broad, but I guess it's about a kind of active safety net. Mm. Let them sort of go and pursue their lives the way they want, obviously within reason. You're helping them with seatbelts and you're keeping them in car seats and you're keeping them safe. Mm-hmm. But there's a kind of letting go that begins in the moment they enter the world. And as the years go, you let them go further and further and further out into the world. You can't hold them back, and I don't want to, you know, I want them to be who they are in whatever way they see fit. Mm. Unless they become Republicans.
How do I not raise a Republican? That's why I don't want kids. I'm like too afraid I'm gonna give birth to a Republican. Okay, last question, because somehow it's been an hour, but this has been so fun. So somebody's asking, how do you balance humor? A question by Deacon. How we balance humor with seriousness as fathers or as parents when we're approaching these conversations, right? So he says, you know, with my 8-year-old, I use humor to try and engage with him, but I recognize that the distance can I actually create more distance between them. How do you, what's the trifecta of like dad jokes and but also being there and being like, you can be there with me?
I think it all comes down to, in my experience, it all comes down to a level of honesty. Mm. Joke can be really honest and funny and true and silly. I know for myself when I'm using humor as a defense mechanism, as opposed to trying to get to something. Mm. And a lot of times, like, especially with teenagers, like, they don't want to hear it. I mean, they just don't want to hear it. I didn't want to hear it. So you use whatever you can, whatever tools are at your disposal. And still, in my experience, that often isn't enough. But I return to the same thing. I know you don't want to hear me right now. I love you. I'm here for you. If you need me, if you want to talk about it, I'm here. You know, I've tried to force conversations. It doesn't work. I've made every mistake and continue to make every mistake, which is why I'm a little bit loath to give practical parenting advice. But I try, you know, and I think that's part of it, is showing up and trying and not giving up, just trying.
Yeah. And I think authenticity, right? That like, if the joke feels, you know, I think teenagers have a really good like bullshit meter and they kind of know when you're just trying to make things cool and loose. So authenticity can go a long way, but and the fact that you've made mistakes makes you an amazing advice giver, because you have been able to, you know, I'm sure think about them and reflect on them, and therefore help us all out becoming better parents. I think we have to wrap up, even though I kind of don't want to. I had like 20 more questions. I wanted to ask you about Joe Rogan. I wanted to touch on a bunch of other stuff we didn't have time to. But it just means that everyone is going to have to go buy the book. If you do not have the book already, it is such a beautiful read. It is so authentic. It is so raw. As I've said, I'm really glad that this book exists. And I really hope it will entice and encourage more fathers and just men to have conversation with their fathers. Cause I think, I can't think of how different the world could be if Donald Trump had had a conversation or a book like this from his father. And I'm so glad that you're modeling that for so many, other men, and hopefully it can become like a whole movement of men really having these candid, open conversations with each other.
Well, Liz, thank you so much for the thoughtful questions and for taking the time out of your schedule to do this. It means a lot to me. And thanks for even blurbing the book and everything. You continue to do great work in this arena. And it's inspiring. So thank you.
Thank you. You're so sweet.
Thanks so much again, Liz and Michael, for showing up here tonight. We appreciate you so much. Once again, you can get A Better Man at Greenlight Bookstore. We have signed copies, so the link is right there in the chat. Thank you guys all for joining us, and have a great night.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.